Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to introduce the first speaker, Mr. Michael Uden. You may begin.
Great. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Michael Uden. I am the Acting Assistant Secretary here at the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education. I want to thank you all for joining us today. I'd also like to take a minute and thank you for your leadership. You guys are without doubt leading the way in improving outcomes for kids. We've begun this process to provide you with the space that you need to innovate, to improve the quality of instruction, increase academic achievement. So we're really looking forward to working with you. We had a great peer review process from that first submission on November. From the request submitted on November 14th, we learned a lot from that peer review. The purpose of today's session is to provide you with lessons learned from that peer review process. So I hope this is really informative and helpful to you as you continue to prepare your requests. I just want to say I know you all are working really hard to get this done. This is really exciting work. This is really important work. And I just need you to know that my office, my staff, my team, we are here to support you in this effort. You know, we've said this a number of times in different venues. This isn't a competition, so one state is not competing against another. So we can provide you with, you know, unlimited amounts of TA and support. So to the extent you need it, we can help you. We're there to do it. You know, we found that it was very helpful to some states in the last submission to really kind of hammer out with our team some state-specific issues. So we have our office hours. Contact our staff. We're really here to support you. I mean that sincerely. So, you know, I'm going to stop here, turn it over to Victoria Hammer, who's going to, you know, walk you through. But I look forward to continuing to work with you. And getting your requests and getting them onto the peer reviews. So thank you. Victoria?
Thank you, Michael. And thank you very much, everyone, for joining us today. Michael mentioned contacting us to tap into our office hours where staff can speak with you about your specific requests. And a bit later in the webinar, we're going to make sure you have that contact information. But again, just thank you for joining us today. And as Michael noted, and as I know many of you know, on December 5th through 9th, the department conducted a peer review of the flexibility requests submitted on November 14th, 2011. The peer panels consisted of 7 people with expertise in standards and assessments, accountability, and educator evaluation systems. Among the 7 peers were experts in the area of students with disabilities and English learners. The peers included representatives from states, advocacy groups, academia, and think tanks. The peer panels generated 1 set of notes for each of the 11 states that submitted requests. After the peer review, the department analyzed the peer panel notes and identified some strengths and challenges across the 11 sets of notes. In addition, we at the department identified some issues that we wanted to highlight with you related to completing specific sections of the request. So that leads me to the purpose of our webinar today, which is to share with you the cross-cutting issues that we and the peers identified. In doing so, we point out some strategies that you might want to consider for strengthening the requests that we know that you have underway. We also offer some additional resources that may be helpful both to states revising their initial submissions and to states preparing requests for submission in February. I would like to note at the outset that the additional resources provided on several slides we're going to go over today are examples of what may be useful resources to you in the states, and we provide them to you for your convenience. The department does not control or guarantee the accuracy, relevance, timeliness, or completeness of these resources, and I'll let you know when I'm talking about those particular resources, nor does the inclusion of links to these resources represent an endorsement of them or the organizations that made them available. States are invited to review these resources and consider their possible use as they determine appropriate. There may be other resources available that might also be useful to you. So truly, we're sharing some cross-cutting issues, some resources, and then want to provide you with some helpful tips for those of you that are submitting your requests for the first time. We want to do that throughout this webinar. We hope to have a few minutes for questions at the end of the webinar, but we're going to give you some contact information. We know many of you know already where to submit questions, but we're going to review that and make sure you know how you can get all of your questions answered. So with that, I'm going to just start charging through the lessons learned that we have for you today. The first one is around the consultation requirement in ESCA flexibility. So the first, which I know many of you know, and you probably, I'm sure you're way past this point, but just to refresh your memories as you kind of reflect on what you've provided in this area, the first flexibility element to which you must respond and peers review is the consultation requirement. To meet this requirement, as noted on this slide, states must describe how they meaningfully engaged and solicit input from teachers and teacher representatives, diverse communities, and other stakeholders. So in the review guidance, you will note that this group of people might include people such as parents, teachers, community-based organizations, civil rights organizations, and others. On this requirement, across several requests, the peers noted that many states did not provide strong evidence of active consultation with teachers and their representatives or with diverse communities, particularly students with disabilities and English learners, advocates in those two communities, people in your states representing those two communities. The peers noted several strategies to address these concerns that they identified under the consultation requirement, and these are strategies that you might want to consider to strengthen your request. And they include things like multiple methods of communication with the entities with whom the state must consult. So, for example, providing both surveys, doing focus groups, having advisory committees, community engagement forums, and outreach to teachers within the state are the types of multiple methods of communication that the peers felt constituted rigorous consultation. Another strategy the peers felt strongly about was consider active engagement with stakeholders at the outset of the process. Many of you, we believe, have embarked on that already, but this even though it's so right now at this time in January, it would be it could be very beneficial to consult in an active way, engage in an active way with these stakeholder groups. The type of engagement might include mechanisms such as flexibility work groups, or use of a consultation action plan with dedicated staff to implement it. Those were some samples the peers felt strongly about in this area. And one piece we wanted to make sure to remind you to do is to note the specific changes based on the feedback that you might have received from these groups. Note those changes in your request. Moving on to Principle 1. As many of you know, Principle 1 requires states to provide a transition plan to implement college and career-ready standards and prepare teachers to teach all students to those standards. While we're not going to go too into depth on this particular topic, this cross-cutting issue of professional development for all teachers that teach students with disabilities, the peers felt that across requests this was not a strength, that states could have fleshed out more their response to this requirement. We're not going to go too into depth on this topic because our last webinar focused exclusively on addressing the needs of students with disabilities and English learners in the context of ESCA flexibility. And you will be able to find that PowerPoint in its entirety on our ESCA flexibility website in the Support for State section shortly. That is not available yet, but you will be able to find that there in the next week or so. And later in this presentation, we give you the website where you're going to be able to find that PowerPoint. However, just to quickly review for those of you that did not participate in the last webinar, I'm going to just give you some areas that the peers, some strategies that the peers identified as ways that states may strengthen their request in this area. And the first one is training all staff, not just special education staff, to use tiered instructional strategies and accommodations. Another suggestion, and this we have more information on the webinar that I just referenced on this topic, is incorporating universal design for learning practices into a state's curriculum design. Peers also identified specifically addressing the needs of students with disabilities in a state's model curriculum as another effective strategy. And peers talked a lot about integrated professional development plans to ensure all teachers deliver challenging content to students with disabilities using differentiated instruction. So integrated professional development plans that include both content teachers and special education teachers, and that's what they meant by integrated professional development plans. And the last strategy that the peers identified was collaboration with experts and advocates for students with disabilities to identify research-based practices and include those in your transition plan. In addition to weaknesses in the plans with respect to students with disabilities, peers also noted a weakness across requests in a lack of detail for supporting teachers of English learners. And this includes teachers in language instruction education programs, elementary teachers, and secondary content teachers. It wasn't just one group of teachers, but it was generally across teachers who teach English learners. Again, this was one of the topics from our last webinar, so I'm not going to review this slide in depth. However, just to quickly review for those of you who did not participate in that webinar, I wanted to highlight some of the strategies that the peers felt were good ways to address supporting teachers of English learners. And one is better supporting teachers to help English learners acquire content knowledge as these English learners develop language proficiency. Another strategy is providing professional development that includes strategies and resources for content instruction to English learners who might not yet be proficient in the language used to explain that content. So it's ways that allow English learners to get at the content. And this is one of those slides where we actually list some resources for you. We haven't actually provided the websites, but rather we've provided the names of the entities or organizations that if you pop these into your browser, will be pulled up right away. If you do go to the webinar that's going to be, again, posted online in about a week, you will be provided with specific websites for these resources and a few more resources as well. So moving on to Principle 2. As you know, I'm sure from having dug into the flexibility requests, that in Principle 2, states need to propose, they're required to propose an accountability system likely to improve student achievement and school performance, close gaps, and increase the quality of instruction for all kids. That's all students, it's students with disabilities, it's English learners, and it's students in high poverty schools and districts. States need to provide a plan to implement no later than the 2012-2013 school year. The first issue that emerged across requests in Principle 2 was complex index systems that include multiple components and many factors within the components that could make it difficult for parents and other stakeholders to understand how exactly a school is rated or graded. So, for example, some states propose systems that include achievement, growth, gap closure, and college and career readiness. This might sound familiar to you if you've reviewed the requests and as you've been thinking about how you are going to create a system that includes multiple indicators of school performance. And across these components, states included many indicators, allotted points for them, calculated scores for them based on these indicators in some way to rate or grade schools with an accountability system. The peers were concerned about the potential complexity here and, again, the ability of the public to understand how the system works in general, how it is that a school gets a particular rating or grade from such a system. On a related concern, peers also questioned the capacity of these types of index systems to differentiate among schools. And an example here is in a state with an A through F grading system, for example. You might have seen some examples of this out there that identifies many schools as B schools or C schools. What's going to differentiate among these schools? What's the capacity of the system to make a difference between a school that's just a B or a school that's almost at an A? So one strategy peers identified, and this is mainly with respect to the complexity of a system that parents or other stakeholders might have difficulty understanding. And this strategy seems intuitive, and we say this though because we know that states have many things on their minds when they're completing these requests. It's no trivial task to work your way through this request. So for states to provide actually a clear explanation of how factors in the index roll up into accountability determination. So, for example, some requests actually laid out steps of making a determination based on the index, or providing an actual example, and those seem to kind of demonstrate exactly how an index system would work, or a grading system would work. And the thinking is consider parents or members of the public reading and be able to understand in general how it is that their child school will receive a particular grade. A strategy related to the second cross-cutting issue on this topic, the issue of differentiating among schools, is making sure that you put a mechanism into place to differentiate within a rating or a grade. So this is about showing where in a performance level, again, a particular school falls. So in our school grading system, we had the example of many schools being graded as B schools, and of course there's a range of B schools that are almost A schools and B schools that just got out of C school status. So it's a matter of, it might be a matter of identifying where in the distribution of schools in each level a school falls, so it is clear if a school is at the top or bottom of a level, or some states propose things like a plus or minus for the rating to indicate where a school was in the range of a performance level. Peers also suggested as ways to address these two cross-cutting issues within an accountability, within an index as part of an accountability system, that states within a system give significant emphasis to measures of achievement, growth, and graduation rates. And that would be a way to demonstrate that it's academic factors contributing most to school ratings. It's how students are doing that's contributing most to your school ratings. Another strategy, again, perhaps kind of an intuitive strategy, but in thinking about so many things, you might not automatically think of things like developing materials to explain connections among the indicators in your index scores, observable outcomes. What are outcomes that schools and parents and other stakeholders can understand, and what are strategies that schools can use to act on these observable outcomes? Some states shared with us the materials that they're going to provide to their public around their systems, and some states didn't, although they had them readily available and they were able to provide them for us when we asked about that. And finally, a piece that we certainly hope you'll consider as you're working through your requests, and if your index is currently not doing something like this, we would think that it might be useful for you to consider giving adequate weight to subgroup, not just overall, but subgroup performance to ensure subgroup accountability. Peers also expressed concern regarding possible unintentional weakening of graduation rate accountability in their proposed systems. So, as we know you know, and as we've stated before, the 2008 graduation rate regulations remain in place. Those are not waived under ESEA flexibility. However, states have considerable flexibility as to how they incorporate graduation rates into their overall accountability systems. So to ensure that states maintain strong graduation rate accountability, the peers suggested that states might do things such as including subgroup graduation rates in an index. So not just the graduation rate of the all students group, but perhaps graduation rates by subgroup, increasing the weight of the graduation rate measure. That's kind of a simple one and a more basic one, but can be very powerful when you have many indicators within an accountability system, and so that each indicator ends up having relatively small weights, including a measure of a dropout rate, or including a zero score for each dropout in the achievement measure. And of course, kind of a stand aside that you might want to consider, and this truly emphasizes graduation rate, is when you actually take it out of your index and include it as a separate measure in conjunction with your index scores. So, as you may know from reading the request posted online and some of the previous webinars that we've held for states preparing requests, some states proposed to use combined subgroups in their accountability system. So when we say combined subgroups, we mean, for example, a subgroup that's constituted of the lowest performing 25% of students, or it's constituted of high need students based on proficiency below the state mean, or perhaps you're combining some of the traditional ESEA subgroups. So there are different ways to create a combined subgroup. And while peers certainly noted some of the advantages of such a subgroup, they had concerns as well. And they suggested what they found in a few of the requests, that you might strengthen your request by doing things such as ensuring sufficient checks, if you will, on a combined subgroup by doing these types of things. Identifying schools in which a single traditional ESEA subgroup performs substantially below the state average as focus schools. So you might have an emphasis in your accountability system on a combined subgroup, but you don't want to lose accountability for the ESEA subgroups, subgroups on which you're required to report, subgroups on which you want to schools to focus on when they might persistently be missing achievement targets. Another strategy is meaningfully including annual measurable objectives, AMOs, for all ESEA subgroups as part of the accountability system. That kind of relates to what I said previously about using subgroup performance in your system. Or you might want to require interventions in schools in which an ESEA subgroup misses AMOs over a number of years. We've recently seen some strategies in states where the planning that they require their schools to do has an element where schools consider subgroups that miss the AMOs and identify strategies that they're going to implement to address that concern. So as you know, under the flexibility, states must use student performance against the AMOs as one measure in identifying incentives and support for Title I schools not identified as priority or focus. We've talked with a lot of states about this, and we've talked with on our webinars before. We want you to be mindful. 85%, potentially 85% of the schools in your state will not be identified as focus or priority. And the challenge is for you to identify incentives and supports for those schools. And one requirement to do under the flexibility is that you use somehow annual measurable objective performance in this area. So peers suggested ways to strengthen requests in this area, and those include using subgroup performance against AMOs to differentiate schools within a grade or category. So again, going back to our school grade example, you might have many schools as B schools, many schools as C schools. Within those B and C schools, would there be any way to signal particular persistent poor achievement of a subgroup? How can you use those AMOs to differentiate within a grade or category? Another strategy is using subgroup performance against AMOs to focus delivery of support services to close achievement gaps. And that's really what I was saying about some states requiring a needs assessment type of activity in each of their schools and having them consider student performance against AMOs to identify where they're going to focus their efforts. So the last cross-cutting issue in Principle 2 involves weaknesses in the area of interventions and supports for students with disabilities and English learners. And in this space, the peers identified some pretty specific weaknesses that they saw across the request. The first one is around generic interventions that don't specifically target the needs of kids with disabilities and English learners. They found as well some states proposing strategies for these particular groups of students that emphasize a more traditional sort of thinking around remedial or developmental programs rather than access to the content of the college and career-ready standards that are intended for all kids. And lastly, they noted a lack of focus on improving the content instruction for all students. So you could see kind of a theme across principles 1 and 2 with respect to weaknesses for these particular students, and it's this ensuring that these students have access to the content in meaningful ways, in ways that all kids have access to the content, and to improve instruction for these kids in the way that states are improving instruction for all kids. And actually, for some ways that you can think about strengthening your requests or ensuring what you have in your requests as they are now is robust and really addresses the requirements, I'm going to point you to the webinar. The webinar is entitled Addressing Students with Disabilities and English Learners. We held it on January 10th, 2012, and it really goes in depth into some strategies that you might want to think about for addressing the needs of students with disabilities and English learners, both in Principle 1 and Principle 2, and you will find that shortly on our website. So finally, we are at Principle 3, And peers identified some cross-cutting issues in Principle 3 that we truly know states are working through in the area of teacher and leader evaluation systems. They're working on this for flexibility. They're working on this for the school improvement grant program. They're working on this, those Race to the Top states. So they're working on this for multiple programs, and we know that. We know that the efforts that you put across these programs will hopefully will be able to increase your work in this area in general. So the peers noted lack of specifics on process for validity and reliability of the measures in your system and how these measures are going to be consistently applied across LEAs. The second cross-cutting issue, again, we know that people, states across the country are working to address this issue. The peers identified, though, concerns around the measures that states intend to use to evaluate teachers of non-tested grades and subjects. At this point, what I'm going to do, what we're going to do with respect to these concerns is we're going to give you really some of what we found to be the best resources in the field to date on addressing these issues, and I won't read them for you out loud, but we've given you the exact titles of some resources that you can find. The first set of resources you can find all available at the National Comprehensive Center for Teacher Quality. On 17, you can find information at our Reform Support Network, some excellent resources for you available there. That's off of our website. We have cited a resource from the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards, and then there's a toolkit on our website that we think you might find particularly useful in addressing some of the concerns in Principle 3. So finally, in Principle 3 as well as in Principle 1 and 2, the peers noted some weaknesses in some elements, again, with respect to students with disabilities and English learners. So in particular, peers noted that they didn't believe the process states put forward for soliciting input on guidelines for evaluating teachers of English learners and students with disabilities to be a very robust or well-articulated process. They found a weakness in the rubrics used to train and evaluate teachers and principals addressing the classroom instruction of English learners and students with disabilities. And in general, they had concerns about how the system would meaningfully include teachers of English learners and students with disabilities who teach these kids part-time or teach multiple classes or serve as resource teachers. Again, I'm going to point you to the webinar that we held on January 12th. I believe you'll find some excellent resources there for thinking through how you might want to strengthen your requests in this area. And actually, at this point, I am going to turn the presentation over to my colleague, Christy Imholtz, who's going to discuss the top five reminders as you work through your flexibility requests. And these are pieces that we identified at the department that we think would strengthen your requests with respect to the peers evaluating them, fully understanding all the work that you put into them. So I'm going to turn it over to Christy.
Thanks, Victoria. As Victoria mentioned, we just wanted to take a few minutes to give you some helpful hints or reminders on actually filling out your request form. So these are based on the requests that we received in November and thought we would give you the top five things to keep in mind. Number one, in your request, remember to address all components of the question or topic in the request form and address them in the designated section of the request. This is particularly important in Principle 2, which has a lot of different components. SEAs should use Section 2A to describe their broad accountability system. This might include things like an SEA's grading system, performance targets for areas not included in their annual measurable objectives or AMOs, or the state's theory of change. Discussions of topics like the identification of reward, priority, and focus schools should actually occur in their designated sections rather than in 2A. For example, reward schools should, that discussion should occur in Section 2C, priority schools in Section 2D, focus schools in Section 2E. Also, in Section 2B, as a reminder, where an SEA proposes its new ambitious but achievable AMOs, an SEA should remember to only include the new AMOs for reading, language, arts, and math, and the method used for setting it. not other performance targets for other factors like school climate or college and career readiness. If an SBA wishes to have a performance target for these areas, they should be included in Section 2A, the SBA's broad accountability system. Reminder number two. Consider addressing questions in italicized bullets from the ESEA Flexibility Review Guidance. This review guidance provides guidance on what reviewers will be looking for and taking into consideration as they comment on your request. Use both the numbered questions and italicized bullets in the guidance to help inform your decisions about what to include. A good example of this is in Section 3B, where states ensure LEAs implement teacher and principal evaluation and support systems. You might want to consider addressing the italicized bullets in the review guidance by including the following: a process for reviewing and approving an LEA system for consistency with SBA guidelines, a process for ensuring LEAs involve teachers and principals throughout the development, piloting, and implementation of those systems, or a process for ensuring measures used are valid and implemented in a consistent, high-quality manner across schools in an LEA. In other words, a process for ensuring inter-rater reliability. These are just some things you might want to consider as you're filling out your request form. Reminder number three. Remember that when the request form asks the SBA to provide a plan, such as in Sections 1B, 1C, Option B, 2A, or Section 3A, Option A, SBAs need to provide a high-quality plan. That high-quality plan includes the components listed here on the slide: key milestones and activities, a detailed timeline, party or parties responsible, evidence, resources, significant obstacles. These components are also listed in the front of the request document. Remember to thoroughly address all these pieces so that your reviewers have a complete picture of what you are trying to do. Reminder number four, make sure you have correctly identified and calculated your reward, priority, and focus schools. Remember that an SBA must demonstrate that they have identified the correct number of schools in each category consistent with the definitions in ESEA flexibility. The department recently issued a document titled Demonstrating that an SBA's lists of schools meet ESEA flexibility definitions to provide technical assistance to states in how they can demonstrate that they meet this requirement. You may want to look at this document, which is available on the department's website listed here. And finally, reminder number five. This is the simple and straightforward one, but sometimes a helpful reminder. Make the request easy to read and to follow for someone who has never read it before or may not be familiar with the intricacies of your state and its system. This includes little things like page numbers, clear labeling of attachments, including both in the electronic versions and on the documents itself so they can be easily located, headings to help your reader follow your organization and structure, and just elaborating and giving full explanations. These small things will help the reviewer better follow your request and understand your thinking so that there are fewer questions or areas for confusion. We hope these tips will be helpful as you finalize your requests in the coming weeks. If you have questions as you are working on your requests in the coming weeks, feel free to submit them to the mailbox at ESEAflexibility@ed.gov, or in another plug, send them to your ESEA Flexibility contact at the department and set up an opportunity to talk about your thinking through those office hours. Remember, requests for Window 2 are due Tuesday, February 21st, and you should submit those requests to the ESEAflexibility@ed.gov mailbox.
Thank you so much, Christy. So actually at this time, we do have 20 minutes left on the webinar, and while we will not keep you any longer absolutely than is necessary, we do want to open up the line for questions if anybody would like to ask a question in this forum.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, dial star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, dial star 1. One moment. We do have a question in queue. One moment, please. If you queued up to ask a question, your line's open.
Hi, I have a question about Principle 2B about AMOs. For states that are interested in calculating AMOs that are differentiated at the school, district, and subgroup level, especially for large states, how should we submit that information as part of our request? Since the request requires all AMOs to be calculated, it's just a large number of AMOs and we weren't sure how to submit it.
So what you should do in that regard, and thanks for the question, that's a really good question. Can I ask who where you're from?
This is Pooja Agarwal from Illinois.
Well, hello, I'm from Illinois as well, so it's nice to get a question from our friends and colleagues in Illinois. So this is a good question, and what the answer is what you should do is provide the state-level AMOs separately for reading language arts and mathematics. So if you're using the method where you would cut the gap in half in 6 years between the percent of kids currently proficient and 100, you should provide what that calculation would be for the all students group and each of the required subgroups at the state level. And then you should describe your process for ensuring that that happens then at the LEA and the school level. So the state is going to then set those at the LEA and the school and the subgroup level, and you can indicate that in your request.
Great. And then a follow-up question, since a mention was made in today's webinar about providing evidence related to sort of the differentiation of schools, so making sure that the way the indexes are structured help to differentiate between schools. Do we need to be able to provide a number for this many schools get an A rating or a B rating or however our rating system and designation system works?
So it's not necessarily that we would expect you to provide the specific number of schools that will be identified in each category. Sometimes that type of information that was very helpful to peers because then they can better understand your system. But I think to the extent that you can, describing the system with all of the pieces in the system, and then I think that if additional information is warranted in terms of kind of the implications of the system that you had arranged, then it's something that we will follow up with you on. Is this helpful? Is this making sense? I mean, the more information that you can provide about the system that you are proposing is very helpful to peers. It helps them consider whether the request whether what you're proposing is educationally sound, it's technically sound, the number of schools that are going to be identified sort of across the distribution. Without having that type of information, it can be a more challenging to fully evaluate the system. I think also it indicates the system is fully developed, and it will be so it's another indicator of the ability of the system to be implemented at the beginning of the 12-13 school year as per the requirements. So I wonder, let me just make sure my colleagues don't have anything to add, but I think the more information you can provide, the better.
Hi, this is Lexi Baer with the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education. I just add to that showing that you have run an index and you know where the not necessarily each individual school would fall out because it might change if you choose to rerun at the end of the year, can be helpful for the peers to see and for you as well to know the implications, especially if you need to make any adjustments to it. I think that's something that the peers would be looking to in terms of the viability of the system.
Great. Thank you.
So we do have a couple questions coming in our chat function before we take another question live. And the first question is about the PowerPoint from last week's webinar. It's not available yet, and we anticipate it being available likely within a week. If it is not available, we will write it down and we will send on a listserv information about when it will be available. Appreciate the question because it's got a lot of good information on it, so we absolutely want to make it available to you as soon as possible. We had another question around states having a separate rubric for teachers of students with disabilities and English language learners. And I think that certainly we're not asking for a separate rubric necessarily, but some way of specifying how the teachers who all teachers, again, I think one of the things that the peers identified was in request was identifying how all teachers that teach these students, how the evaluation will be appropriate for that, for both applying to content classroom teachers and teachers of students with disabilities and English language learners. So I think it's more an explicit description or explanation of how rubrics accommodate teachers who teach those particular subgroups of kids. It's a good question, though. If I get any further information on that, your name has popped up on our chat function, so I will make sure, Karen, to get back to you on that good question. Any other questions people have?
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, dial star 1. There's another question in queue. One moment. If you queued up to ask a question, your line is open.
Hi, this is Lou Fabrizio from North Carolina. And I know that my question is one that's going to probably require some judgment on our part, but I'll ask it anyway. On occasion, when the U.S. Department of Education requires states to submit information, we're specifically told to not include any kind of URLs in the application because the reviewers will not have any kind of access to computers to check a URL. I can see how our proposals could be rather lengthy if we decide to include manuals that have been developed as part of professional development that indicates how extensive our professional development is, or indicates all of the intricacies of our teacher and principal evaluation system, which is already in place, which we've already done workshops, communication methods that we've had of newsletters and those type things. Do you really expect us to include all of those things, or just to provide some examples and then give a URL to say, here's where you can find other copies of newsletters and other things that we have done to keep people in the loop?
No, thanks for the question, Lou. That's a good question, and you are absolutely welcome to provide links to lengthy documents. And I would advise just that you, and I'm sure you will, Lou, and everyone in the States listening on this webinar, to check the links, just make sure that they work, that should absolutely suffice to submit what can be very lengthy documents at times. We would advise you as well, though, if you are submitting a lengthy document and you want peers to hone in on a particular portion or section of that document to find information on a particular element, that you note that in the text, because the requests are long, and then with documents they really become very, very long quite quickly, and we want peers to be able to identify the information right away that addresses the element. So we would encourage you to provide that information, but links are absolutely fine.
And if you do use a link, just make sure, the peers will have access to them electronically, but they'll also have them printed. Just make sure that if it's printed, it's clear that there is a link there, that it's not just hyperlinked within the text, but that it either spells out the link or it notes that this is a link, just so that they don't miss it when they're reading it on paper.
Thank you.
There are no further questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, we will end our webinar session for today. We, again, want to thank you for joining us, and we Appreciate all the work that we know you are putting into these requests. We look forward to talking with you about them. And if you have questions on the office hours, and we look forward to sending them forward to the peer review. So best of luck to you in the next few weeks as you continue to work on the requests. And please keep in touch with us. And as Michael Uden said to you, we really want to help you move through this process. And this is the start of the process for many of you. So we look forward to working with you. Good afternoon. Bye-bye.
And this concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.